So turn again, please, to Matthew chapter 7 and verses 1 to 6. Judge not. Judge not. That's the emphatic note on which our passage this morning begins. Now, both in Greek and in English, this verb to judge can mean different things in different contexts. What does it mean here? Well, it means to verbally confront someone regarding that person's faults. Notice verse 4. How can you say to your brother, dot, dot, dot? So judging in this passage is saying to someone, you are wrong. You've got a problem. You're at fault. I want us to be clear from the outset this morning, that's the kind of judging that Jesus has in mind. Now, some of you may already be feeling a little uneasy at where this sermon is going. You're thinking, perhaps, hang on a minute, Dan. The thing you've just described there, verbally confronting someone regarding that person's faults, that surely is a proper and an appropriate thing to do. Jesus himself does it often during his life on earth. And indeed, on more than one occasion, he tells us to do it ourselves. If your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault. He will instruct us in chapter 18, verse 15. Saying you are wrong may be the cardinal sin of our increasingly thin-skinned society, but the Bible just doesn't view things that way. That kind of thinking may already be in your mind because of what I said a moment ago. Well, my response to that is, yes, you're quite right. You're quite right. And that's why, then, we mustn't rip verse 1 out of its context and turn it into an absolute prohibition that rules out all criticism, all rebuke, all correction, all disapproval. It's not intended to be isolated like that. It's intended to be read along with verses 2 to 6, where Jesus specifies certain types of judging, certain types of verbal confrontation, certain types of criticism and rebuke that are to be avoided. Yes, judging, in the sense we're talking about this morning, it can be good and right and beneficial, and there are numerous Bible passages that demonstrate that. But judging is not always good and right and beneficial. It can be done in wrong ways and it can be done in wrong situations. And that's the concern of this passage here. And it's into those contexts then where we are tempted to confront someone and the way we are going about it is wrong, or perhaps the situation itself just doesn't call for confrontation. It's into those contexts that Jesus speaks these powerful two words, judge not. And so this morning then we need to explore further at what points exactly those two words kick in. When does criticizing a person's faults, which as we've said can be good and right and beneficial, when does criticizing a person's faults become instead the target of Jesus' prohibition here? Well, notice with me this morning, it becomes the target of Jesus' prohibition here at least three different points. And first of all then, there's a judging that is not humble. There's a judging that is not humble. And this is what verse 2, I think, is about. So, there have been, I've been at concerts where I've been inside the venue in very good time, long before the concert begins. And as the place is filling up and the sense of anticipation is mounting, there on the stage, final preparations are being made so that everything is completely ready for that moment when the musicians will walk out. And those final preparations, they always include the musical instruments being tested. And so some guy will go and pluck a few strings on each guitar and play a few notes on the piano and have a little bash on the drums, just checking that everything's in tune, everything's plugged in, everything is good to go. And sometimes I think to myself, it must be so tempting for that guy to get carried away as he's doing that job. There he is on stage, and there's a crowd in front of him, and he's got Bruce Springsteen's guitar in his hand, or some singer's microphone at his lips. How tempting for that guy to think for a moment that he's the star that everyone has come to see, to just close his eyes and belt out some song, to temporarily forget who he is, that actually he's just an ordinary guy who in 20 minutes' time will be off stage listening like everyone else to the real musicians playing those instruments. And you know, every time that it's necessary for you or I to criticize someone, to confront someone regarding a failing or misdemeanor of some kind, we face, I think, the same temptation as that guy in my illustration. We can get carried away. It can go to our heads. We can feel this rush of moral authority suddenly coursing through our veins. We can almost think for a moment that we're the Lord himself, searching out minds and hearts in the language of Revelation 2:23. We can temporarily forget who we are, that we are just ordinary men and women who one day ourselves will be summoned like everyone else to appear before the real judge, the real searcher of minds and hearts. And that's why Jesus, there in verse 2, makes such a big deal then of our own accountability to that higher judgment seat. Not in order to deter us from ever judging anyone, as we've said several times, judging others sometimes is appropriate, but in order to deter us from judging anyone high-handedly, rather enjoying the experience of judging this other person. I wonder, have you ever done that? Have you ever given someone a piece of your mind, a really sharp rebuke, and actually derived a certain degree of pleasure from doing so, and found it all quite empowering at some level? Jesus stresses here our accountability to that higher judgment seat, in order to deter us from that kind of judging, a judging that isn't humble. When you and I find ourselves having to confront a wrongdoer, or sometimes we will find ourselves having to confront a wrongdoer, the words with which we do it may have to be strong, but the spirit in which we do it should always be meek. Because at the end of the day, we're not that person's judge. We may have a responsibility to judge that person in a provisional sense. In that particular instance, it may be right that we step in and reprimand them. But we're not really that person's judge. That person's judge is Jesus Christ. And on the day that that person stands before Jesus Christ, we too shall also stand before Jesus Christ. A spirit of meekness and humility in judging others is always required, therefore. Never relish, never smug superiority. I'm saying in the first place this morning, there's a judging that simply is not humble. But then secondly, notice with me, there's a judging that's not credible. There's a judging that's not credible. And this is verses 3-5. And so this is where then you confront someone who is at fault, and that person really is at fault, so that the confrontation, the judging in itself is warranted. But the problem is this: at the same time that you're confronting this other person's misbehavior, a worse form of misbehavior is going on in your own life, so that your judging has no weight to it. It can't possibly be taken seriously. It is utterly undermined by your failure to put your own house in order. In the language Jesus uses in verse 5, it's hypocritical. Why should anyone listen to a rebuke from someone who deserves an even harsher rebuke? It simply does not have any credibility. Now, this hypocritical judging then, sometimes it can be very deliberate. So it might be a Christian minister who in his preaching and pastoral work really lays into his congregation about some particular sin. Or a church member who in his relationship with other church members is similarly hardline and uncompromising. But it isn't actually genuine moral outrage that's driving that minister or driving that church member. The whole thing is instead a clever way of deflecting attention from a worse sin in that minister's life or in that church member's life. I think that's the worst form of hypocritical judging. And it happens. It does happen. You get people who do this, who gain a reputation in Christian circles for being so zealous, so puritanical, so disapproving of sinful behavior. And in fact, it's all just a big screen to cover up their own degenerate conduct. So hypocritical judging of the kind Jesus is describing in verses 3 to 5, it can sometimes be very deliberate. However, that doesn't seem to be what Jesus has in mind here. See those two words toward the end of verse 3? Not notice. Not notice. In the situation Jesus has in mind, the person doing the judging is somehow blind to the hypocrisy involved. He doesn't notice it. He issues his rebuke out of a genuine sense of moral outrage, genuinely disgusted at this other person's behavior, even though in fact he's behaving in a worse manner himself. That's the kind of hypocritical judging that Jesus here is talking about. And I'm sure many of us this morning recognize it only too well because we've been there. And we can think of times when we have delivered such strong rebukes and yet really we had more reason to be receiving rebukes at that point than to be giving them. How does that happen? I mean, Jesus says here, doesn't he, that this situation, it's as ridiculous as someone with a plank in their eye. By the way, the ESV's log is way too bland. Actually, the King James Version has it best, I think. Beam. The word that Jesus uses here, the Greek word, it's a word that was used for roof beams. If you're struggling to visualize this text, then when you get home today, go up into your attic and look at those huge pieces of timber that are holding up the roof of your house. That's what Jesus is talking about. And he's saying then here that to confront someone's sins when there are worse sins in your life that are lying undealt with, it's as ridiculous as someone with one of those roof beams sticking out of their eye fussing over some tiny imperceptible speck in another person's eye. How ridiculous. And so how can we do it? If it's as ridiculous as that, then why does it happen? Why in these situations don't we immediately see it as a case of roof beam and speck and shut our mouths in embarrassed silence? Why does it seem reasonable to us to launch into a diatribe against this lesser sinner than ourselves? Well, I think the answer has to do with the nature of sin, and two things in particular. First of all, sin is intoxicating. Sin is intoxicating. What do I mean by that? Well, I mean this. Often when we're engaged in some fairly serious sin, whether it's sexual immorality or financial misconduct or sheer nastiness toward another person, what happens is that that sin clouds our judgment. The sin, as it were, doesn't let us see the sin for what it really is. We don't see it as sexual immorality. We don't see it as financial misconduct. We don't see it as nastiness, as malice toward another person. No, in our minds, it's way more complicated than that. It's way more nuanced than that. There are reasons why I'm behaving like this. Now, in other people, we still recognize sexual immorality as sexual immorality. In other people, we still recognize those sins for what they are. But in ourselves, we find it all so much more complicated. It's a grey area. And hence we arrive at this situation then, where we are rebuking somebody. We are really censoring somebody, even though there's this worse sin going on in our own lives. I assume that's how it worked with the classic example of this that we have in the Bible. David. And remember how David, he hears that story from the lips of the prophet Nathan about a man who has taken the only little lamb that his neighbor owned, even though he had plenty of sheep in his own flock. And David erupts at that. And it's genuine moral outrage. He genuinely finds this appalling, a scandalous situation. But as for his own taking of Bathsheba from Uriah, well, that, of course, is way more complicated. Presumably, he wasn't seeing it in those terms. You know, he'd just been on the roof and, well, the woman was there and, you know, he only called her to his room and one thing led to another. No, it wasn't him. It wasn't him doing like the man in Nathan's story. Way more nuanced. And we need to watch out for this, don't we? This intoxicating, judgment-clouding aspect of sin. I'm sometimes struck by the way in which Jesus, in the Garden of Gethsemane, sees Judas walking toward him. And he asks Judas a question. And this is his question. He says, "Judas, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss?" Luke 22:48. "Are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss?" And at one level, it just seems like the most redundant question that anybody has ever asked. Of course that's what Judas is doing. It's utterly obvious that's what Judas is doing. Why does Jesus say that? Well, perhaps because the one person to whom it's not obvious is Judas himself. Judas has managed to justify this in some way. You know, I'm only just fulfilling my obligation to these guys I'm in a contract with. You know, I've made an arrangement and I'm just helping them. And he perhaps just slanted it, put a gloss on it, put it in different terms. In his mind, he was not betraying to a cruel death the eternal Son of God. That wasn't how he saw it. And Jesus just says that, asks that question, in order to try and puncture this intoxication that has come down on Judas's mind. I remember once years ago hearing Sinclair Ferguson talking about the Christian's mortification, that is, the Christian's fight against sin. And he referred to the slogan that the prosperity preachers use, "Name it and claim it." And he said that he had an alternative slogan that we should use as Christians in the fight against sin: "Say it and slay it." Say it and slay it. And the point of the "say it" bit is this, that often we just don't own up in our own minds to the sins that are there in our lives. We don't say them for what they are. We put them in other terms. We put a gloss on them. We put them in different packaging. We make them complicated when in fact they're not complicated. We don't call them out for what the Bible calls them out to be. And the first part of killing our sins then is owning up to what those sins really are, saying them and then slaying them. And so we all need to watch out for this intoxicating aspect of sin. That, I think, is one of the reasons we get ourselves into these situations where we'll be so hard on another Christian who in fact is living more righteously than we ourselves are. So sin is intoxicating. And then a second reason, sin is idiosyncratic. Sin is idiosyncratic, by which I mean this, that we don't all struggle with the same sins, do we? We have different struggles in our lives as Christians. And so we see a brother or sister in Christ then, and they are committing some sin and they're really being tangled up in this sin. And to us, that sin just isn't a problem. It's never been a problem. It's just not part of our makeup to find that particular sin a problem. And so to us, it just seems so ridiculous that here's this Christian brother and he's struggling so much with that sin. Why is he struggling with it? Why is he finding it so hard? I don't find it hard. And so we come down on that person like a ton of bricks. Whereas, of course, objectively, that person's sin is no worse than the particular sin that I struggle with. But because I don't struggle with that sin, it seems to me like an easy ABC kind of sin that the person should have dealt with at the very beginning of their Christian life. And so we need to watch out for this tendency as well. We need to have this understanding that we struggle in different ways. And just because that person is finding it so hard to overcome a sin that you've never found it hard to overcome, that doesn't mean that you necessarily have the right to come down on that person like a ton of bricks, because the sin that you're struggling to overcome is in fact no better than that sin. So those perhaps are two reasons then why we get ourselves into this ridiculous situation where we're rebuking someone and that rebuke just isn't credible because of what's going on in our own lives. And of course Jesus doesn't say that because of this, and if you are struggling with some sin yourself, then just forget all about ever rebuking someone else. No, it's about the chronological order, isn't it? He says, first, verse 5, take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye. The brother does need the speck taken out of the eye. As we've said repeatedly, faults do need to be confronted. But first of all, make sure that you're in a credible position to do that. And don't be this ridiculous buffoon going around with a roof beam in your eye and picking up on specks in others. Spurgeon has some very helpful practical advice about other people's faults. He says, other men's imperfections show us our imperfections, for one sheep is much like another. We ought to use our neighbours, he says, we ought to use our neighbours as looking glasses to see our faults in, and mend in ourselves what we see in them. So, before rebuking that brother for that misdemeanor in his life, we should use that misdemeanor as a looking glass to make sure that it's not, or some equivalent misdemeanor is not there in us, to make sure that we're in a position to credibly confront our brother or sister. So we said so far this morning, there's a judging that's not humble. And when Jesus says, judge not, he's talking about that. There's a judging that's not credible. And when Jesus says, judge not, he's talking about that as well. But then thirdly and finally, there's a judging that's not sensible. There's a judging that's not sensible. And this is verse 6. And Jesus here then has this very colourful little proverb: do not give dogs what is holy, do not throw your pearls before pigs, lest they trample them underfoot and turn to attack you. And I think that he's still speaking about the same theme. This too belongs to this theme of judging. And his point is this, that there are some people who simply will not take criticism and will not take rebuke. and in fact will invariably react to criticism and rebuke viciously and aggressively, so that you never really get anywhere by rebuking and criticizing such a person, and in fact you endanger yourself by doing so. And Jesus is saying, well, don't bother in those cases. Don't give what is holy, that is, this rebuke which is for the person's good, this beneficial therapeutic rebuke. Don't give that to someone who inevitably is going to react in that aggressive and hostile way. And this applies then, I guess, just at the most basic level. And of course, Jesus here, he's been talking about a brother. How can you say to your brother? But here in verse 6, presumably, he doesn't now have in mind a fellow Christian, this dog, this pig, who throws the rebuke back in your face and endangers you in the process. This isn't a Christian brother, it's just another human being. And so this might apply at work or at school, that there are some situations, there are some people, some colleagues, some people you know, and it's just not worth confronting them because they're this kind of person. There's an aggressiveness about them which means it's just not worth bothering. But then, and John Stott and Don Carson both apply this in this way, it may also apply even at the level of evangelism. Because of course, preaching the gospel inevitably at some point, sooner or later, involves confronting people with faults, doesn't it? Talking about sin. You are a sinner who has broken God's law and stand in need, therefore, of pardon through the cross of Jesus Christ. But if there's a person who has heard that gospel and perhaps heard it repeatedly and yet who just will not accept this notion that they are a sinner and responds with real aggression every time they hear that, there may become a point where it's more profitable to move on and tell someone else the gospel instead. Don Carson, I think, puts this well when he writes that over the years, where he talks about people whose cynical mockery and intellectual arrogance, their love of moral decay and their vaunted self-sufficiency make them utterly impervious to the person and words of Christ. Over the years, he says, I have gradually come to the place where I refuse to attempt to explain Christianity and introduce Christ to the person who just wants to mock and argue and ridicule. It accomplishes nothing good, and there are so many other opportunities where time and energy could be invested more profitably. And of course, we mustn't make that judgment call about someone recklessly and lightly. It's a very solemn business. But there may be situations where that is necessary. And just taking that one step further, I want to close this morning on this note. I want to challenge you not to make sure that, to make sure that none of you are in the dog or pig category that Jesus is describing here. To make sure that you're not in that category when it comes to the gospel of Jesus Christ. Because I guess it can happen over a process of time that you can be somebody who hears the gospel and initially you just think, well, this is okay for others, but it's not for me, and you're fine with the gospel, but you're just not interested yourself. And you keep hearing the gospel and you keep hearing it, and over time that attitude toward it hardens until you start to become rather cynical toward it, and you look around at other Christians in this room and you think, what idiots believing this stuff, this is just nonsense, I hate this. And you're still here perhaps, and you're still listening, but in your mind, you're utterly ridiculing it. And I suppose then that the God who says to his disciples, there may be a point where it's no longer worthwhile to preach that gospel to people, that God may himself decide in some people's cases it's no longer worthwhile for them to be exposed to his gospel. And that could happen to you. And you could be sitting here this morning, and by God's grace, you are still being exposed to the gospel. But you're hardening and you're hardening and you're hardening. And pig's ears and a pig's tail are starting to sprout. And you're becoming this vicious rejecter that Jesus describes here. And I'm saying you're on very dangerous ground. Because there may come a point where God says, no longer. This person will not hear my good news again. If they spit it back at the preacher, and if they ridicule Christians they're amongst, then I'm having nothing more to do with this person. And so I'm saying, don't let yourself become a dog. Don't let yourself get to the point of being a pig. But while God is still allowing you to hear his good news, embrace it. Become a Christian. Accept the rebuke. Accept you're a sinner. Accept that you need to run to Jesus Christ. Run to him. And cling to him. And say, Lord Jesus, I'm a wretch, but you have come to save people like me. Don't let yourself get to that point where you're impenetrably hard, cynical through and through, and God says, I'm done with you. No more gospel for you. May God challenge us all. Amen.